Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We'll be in-depth with a memoir of faith and finding yourself in a challenging world. But first, to a voice from the opinion pages. Foreign policy expert Stephen Cook argues in Politico magazine that although President Trump has bungled some of his international meetings and relationships, he might have some fresh ideas when it comes to the Middle East. He writes, Trump's Middle East policy is not universally bad. In fact, in many ways, it reflects a sound understanding of what the U.S. can achieve in the region, and more importantly, what it cannot. Stephen Cook is a senior fellow for the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of a new book, False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. And he joins us today from Massachusetts. Stephen, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think U.S. presidents should understand that they cannot achieve in the Middle East?
I think when President Trump went to Saudi Arabia in late May, he made a very important statement about the era of the United States lecturing leaders and people in the region about how to live and the way in which the United States has gone about trying to promote change in those countries is over. And as much as I think we'd all like to see democracy flourish in the Middle East, the United States' return on the investment over the course of the last 15 years has been virtually nil when it comes to promoting democratic change. And clearly, the president perceives that the United States has higher priorities than promoting change in a region where people are just manifestly not interested in it at the moment.
Since you mentioned Saudi Arabia, I want to ask you about what you make of the contradiction of the president's rhetoric about radical Islamic terrorism and this travel ban that's aimed at blocking people from certain Muslim countries. And then the lavish praise that he has for Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, is the source of a lot of extreme Islamic teaching and practice. There's a contradiction there.
It is indeed an astonishing irony that the president, who during his campaign took a very tough line on Islamism, in fact, took a very tough line on Saudi Arabia, went there and, in fact, changed his policy. But that's the kind of thing that is a difference between campaign rhetoric and what this administration believes is its priority. And they perceive that Saudi Arabia is actually an ally both in the fight against extremism as well as a part of a united front against Iran. Now, that may or may not be the case, but nevertheless, that is the decision that the administration has made, is that to overlook some of those shortcomings, much of it in the past, and try to bring Saudi Arabia as well as other countries in the region along as firm partners in the fight against Islamic extremism.
And I know that other presidents have done that as well. It's just that President Trump's rhetoric about terrorism and Muslims and this travel ban really stands out from anything that Bush or Obama, who had a good relationship and sought a good relationship with Saudi Arabia, ever said. That's where it's really hard to reconcile what he says and does in some areas and then the way he behaved in Saudi Arabia.
I think that's right. What the Saudis say when you ask them about that, and you point out the fact that there is this very harsh rhetoric about Islam, they say this is a domestic American political issue that is not, that we don't want to get involved in. They say we have priorities. We want to work with the United States. In fact, when President Trump went to Riyadh, he said the words that the Saudis and other leaders in the region have been wanting a U.S. president to say for the better part of the last 8 years about fighting extremism, about confronting Iran, about the era of Americans trying to push democratic change to be over. So they are, unlike, for example, America's European allies, who are deeply uneasy with President Trump, in the Middle East, in particular in the Persian Gulf, there is truly an alignment of worldview between the president and leaders in the region, which is quite, as you point out, is astonishing given his rhetoric about Islam.
And now that we're talking about Iran, is it clear to you what the president is ultimately going to do about this agreement with Iran, whether he's going to pull out, stay in, what?
Well, the Iranians are making it difficult for the president to do what he said that he wanted to do, which was to essentially bring the agreement between the United States, Iran, and the other world powers to an end, because they are complying with the agreement. Now, from what we all understand, the policy is still under review. So it could mean that in October, the administration takes actions to undermine what's called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. We just don't know. It's clear that the administration, however, is looking to take a much firmer and even tougher line on the Iranians. And we see that happening in a place like Syria, where the United States has taken steps in recent weeks to demonstrate resolve and use military force against what they call regime-aligned forces, which is, I think, a roundabout way of saying Iranian and Syrian government forces.
Stephen Cook is with us. If you've just tuned in, he's a voice from the opinion pages. We do this every Tuesday morning. Senior fellow for the Council on Foreign Relations, out with a new book about the Middle East called False Dawn. And we're talking about some of the things that he wrote in this piece for Politico magazine. If you have questions about his view, President Trump's view on the Middle East, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You could tweet them in at Kerry NPR. I want to ask you about what you've said about the Arab Spring, and I'm sure you go into greater detail in the book. You write that the Arab Spring looked deceptively like a moment for democratic change, and then you say, any American effort to forge more democratic and open political systems in the region was bound to fail because the sense of purpose and joy on display in the famous squares of the Middle East masked deeply divided societies. Well, President Obama was in the Oval Office during the Arab Spring. What did he potentially not understand about what was happening during the Arab Spring?
Well, I think that at the moment that the uprisings happened, there was a general sense in Washington and elsewhere that the possibilities were wide open, and that, in fact, what we were looking at in the Arab world was the Middle Eastern analog of the Eastern European revolutions of the late 1980s, early 1990s. In fact, what you had, and I think what the administration missed, was that you did not really have revolutions in the Arab world, that leaders were replaced, but political systems were not overturned. And that made it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for breakthroughs and democratic transitions to occur. And I think that there was this overwhelming sense of joy. And having spent time myself in Tahrir Square, it was hard not to feel the romance of the barricades. But when we looked at it, when you looked at it clearly, you had to come to the conclusion that this was going to be a lot more difficult, if not impossible, for these countries to make this change, this democratic change, because the political systems, these authoritarian political systems, remained largely intact as a result of, even after these uprisings.
Do you think, let's talk about Egypt for a minute, and then we'll talk about how the president talks about the leader of Egypt. Do you think Egypt is worse off today than it was before the events of Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring? Is the society more repressed today than it was even then?
I think it goes without saying that it is. If you look at all of the indicators for Egypt, whether it's economic or social or political, Egypt is far worse off now than it was under Hosni Mubarak, even in the later period of the Mubarak era. Egypt's a profoundly repressive place. It's also a particularly bloody moment in Egyptian history. So whereas Hosni Mubarak looked at the myriad problems that the now president of Egypt faces and saw these problems that could be managed, Abdel Fattah Sisi, the now president of Egypt, who came to power through a coup d'etat in July of 2013, regards these problems as to solve these problems through the combination of coercion and force. And that's how you get the profoundly repressive Egypt. relationship that you have right now.
So you know that President Trump has spoken highly and indicated that there is a certain amount of chemistry or a bond between he and the president of Egypt. I wonder if you think the president of the United States does this with any larger sense of a foreign policy goal in mind, or is some of this just instinctive? I like the guy, he likes me, we can work together.
Well, I don't know President Trump, but it does seem to me that he places a lot of emphasis on personal chemistry. And leaders like Abdel Fattah al-Sisi or King Salman in Saudi Arabia or the Jordanian King Abdullah have spent time watching President Trump and understanding how he responds and have worked hard on building a personal chemistry with them. I think that President Trump sees, if there is a kind of foreign policy strategy behind this, it is one of the things that he articulated through the campaign that has carried through to this moment, which is trying to defeat the Islamic State. And he sees these leaders as allies in them and has less concern about the quality of politics within these countries.
And do you think that's the right approach?
Well, I think because when Arabs rose up and they were unable to force democratic change in the region, and that even with the help of the United States, this effort really came to naught, it's difficult to imagine how a president of the United States, even as influential and powerful, and even in the region apparently as well-liked as President Trump is, can make a difference in the trajectory of politics in those countries. Understand that people in these places believe that they are engaged in a struggle over the heart and soul of their country. When the stakes are so high, it makes it very, very difficult for outsiders, even ones that as influential as the president of the United States, to kind of force or encourage change in the political direction that these leaders have taken.
We haven't talked about Israel and the Palestinians, and you open your piece for Politico talking about the fact that the president sent Jared Kushner to meet with the Israeli and Palestinian leaders together. And you say Kushner, predictably given that he has no relevant experience, quickly failed, setting off a round of snickering among longtime Mideast hands. It was embarrassing for the White House, but in a larger sense, Trump's decision to dive into the peace process was reassuring. How?
Well, not to suggest that the peace process is something that is about to bear fruit and Israelis and Palestinians are going to live side by side in peace forever. But what it did was it suggested that the president and his administration is more interested in a bipartisan foreign policy that has been pursued previously and that has managed the problems of the Middle East fairly well over a long, if you take a long historical view of it, that there is something to pursuing a more conventional foreign policy, even if you take into account the, how shall I put it diplomatically, the particularities of this president and the way he goes about it, that if you cut through those things, he's doing a lot of things that President Bush or President Obama have done in the past. Even in Riyadh, when he spoke to those Arab leaders, he not only said the era of America's effort to kind of socially engineer the Middle East is over, but he reaffirmed America's leadership in countering extremism, in fighting terrorist financing. These are things that are consistent with things that President Bush and President Obama did. Even the effort to dislodge the Islamic State from Raqqa and Mosul is perfectly consistent with what President Obama began. So there is something, again, if you take away the tweets, if you take away the kind of odd pictures of the president in Riyadh holding onto that orb with King Salman and President Sisi, there is, if you strip all that away, there is a consistency to American foreign policy in the Middle East that should make us feel a little bit better given the kind of harsh rhetoric that has come out of this White House.
And Stephen, just one last question here. Do you, as somebody who wants to see progress and better relationships between the United States and a number of other countries, knowing what the White House is consumed with and knowing that the president has a fairly short attention span. I mean, do you look ahead to the next 3.5 years and say there are real possibilities for progress in some of these relationships, or do you kind of wring your hands over the fact that, you know, the focus seems to move every couple of hours out of this White House?
It is deeply concerning that there is no focus, and that although the president campaigned on restoring American leadership, especially in the Middle East, the fact that his administration has been buffeted by scandal and investigations, which are all perfectly legitimate and warranted, is worrying on two fronts. One, it distracts the administration from very real problems around the world. And then I think it is a signal to these countries in the region that they may have to go it alone. And their sense of having to take matters into their own hands during the previous 8 years has contributed to some of the bloodshed and violence and chaos that we do see in the region. For example, in Yemen, or what countries in the region have contributed to the vortex of violence of Syria. Those are things that without the leadership of the White House and the United States with a hollowed out State Department are quite concerning.
Stephen, always a pleasure, and I really appreciate the insight. Thank you.